Welcome once again. Thank you for attending our first teleconference CLE. This is Richard Klemm. We're coming to you from St. Paul, Minnesota today, and we are going to be talking about proof of foreign law after Bodum, a fairly recent decision of the Seventh Circuit. We're doing a live conference call today on April 7th, and we will also be doing this as a podcast. For any podcast listeners in Wisconsin and other states, during the course of the program, I will be saying three code words, write those down. If you're driving, they're easy to remember code words. In fact, they're actually words that are in the materials, so don't get into a car accident writing down code words. But I will be giving those during the program, and for your certificate of attendance, I will need to have you email me those three code words. Today's live program has been approved for credit in Iowa and Minnesota, and Wisconsin credit has been applied for, and the podcast will be applied for in states as noted on my website. If you have any questions during the course of today's live program, please email them to me during the program. I will be checking my email. The email is clem.law@usa.net. And also any podcast listeners, if you have any substantive questions about the program, you can email them to that address, and I will respond to them promptly, well within the time limits set by any of your states. Well, anyway, today what we're going to be talking about is proof of foreign law. There are many cases where the law of a foreign jurisdiction is at issue in a case in the United States. We won't be talking too much about the substantive question of what jurisdiction's law applies. That, of course, is a whole law school course unto itself. But there are many situations where a foreign country's law is relevant in a proceeding in a U.S. court. And in those situations, the question comes up of how do you present that to the court? How do you establish it? How do you prove the foreign law, if you will? The focus of this course is a relatively recent case from last September by the Seventh Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, Bodum USA versus La Cafetière Inc. And that talked about, under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, how foreign law should be established. And to some extent, that case prompted more confusion because it actually prompted three separate opinions by the three-judge panel hearing the case, and those opinions were somewhat conflicting. But I think they can be reconciled, and we will give at the end some practice pointers on how you can present this material to the court in such a manner that it will be accepted by judges following any one of those three philosophies. Well, we're going to start with the common law antecedents to that decision. And at common law, generally, the question of a foreign law was considered to be a question of fact. Now, that's not quite as easy as it was. It wasn't necessarily a jury question, although in some cases it would have been. But conceptually, if the question was, what is the law of Canada or what is the law of France, that would have been a question of fact from a conceptual point of view. And in some cases, that question of fact, like other questions of fact, would actually be decided by the jury. For example, the first case that we have cited here, Electric Welding Company versus Prince, a Massachusetts case from 1909, takes a very conservative approach and says that yes, indeed, many of those questions are questions of fact, And because they are questions of fact, they should be decided by the jury. However, even there, if it was simply a single statute that was at issue, then like any other writing, like a contract has to be construed by the court rather than by the jury, it was treated more or less the same as a written contract because it was just a written statute and the construction of that writing was a question for the law, was a question, it was the type of factual question that was decided by the court. But if it was a case basically applying common law precedents, you know, taking precedents and seeing how they apply to the facts of a particular case, that was deemed to be a question for the jury, drawing analogies from one case. Is this case before us more like the Smith case, or is it more like the Jones case? Because there, it was a case where analogies have to be drawn, that, because it was a question of fact, was decided by the jury. So the jury would hear expert testimony about what the cases were from this other jurisdiction and would have to draw those inferences. The Wisconsin case cited here is somewhat less conservative. And once again, it says that if there is simply a statute before the court, that's probably a question that's probably a question for the court to decide because it's the construction of a writing, about the same as if the court were construing a contract or something. Looks like we have a another caller on board. We're in the lecture mode right now, so thank you for joining us. As I pointed out, if you do have any questions during the course of the program, feel free to email them to me at clem.law@usa.net. And we've just begun here, so we'll just continue on. But as we were saying, the at common law, the question of foreign law was a question of fact, and in many cases, that was a question of fact for the jury. Now, and as I also mentioned, we have a number of code words we're going to be giving today for later podcast listeners. And the first code word in this case is from the name of the first case. And our first code word is welding, W-E-L-D-I-N-G, from the electric welding company case at the beginning of the case. But as this New York case points out, there was some criticism of that approach because, you know, that doesn't really make any sense, especially when you're dealing with a common law jurisdiction like Canada or England, where the court has to consider precedents from a common law perspective. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to have the jury do that because the judge presumably is more learned in the law than these 12 laypersons. So as the court states in this Fitzpatrick case, how the jury can do this as well as the judge, experienced in the law, I cannot quite appreciate. But that was, just to give you a little bit of background of the common law, that's what the law was well into the 20th century. Now, that seems rather odd, and as this New York judge points out, you know, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But one thing to keep in mind is that when you treat these things as question of fact, one thing that that does do is put the party asserting this foreign law to its strict proof, and you know, at least making it meet the a burden of production to bring this foreign law forward, because these were the days prior to the internet, prior to most modern communication. And in fact, probably a time when a county law library or even a university law library might not have very many foreign law materials. A large law library would probably have British and Canadian cases, but even then it might be lacking, and it kind of makes sense that the party seeking to assert this foreign law applies, the onus should be put upon them to bring forward the materials and show that this was indeed the law of that other country. Well, this has been resolved. It's no longer a question of fact. And under the federal rules, under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 44.1 holds, among other things, that it is no longer a question of fact. It is now a question of law. When it comes to the standard of review and things like that, it clearly is a question of law. And most states have adopted a similar rule. Minnesota, for example, has a more or less identical rule of civil procedure, stating that it is a question of fact. I also have quoted here in the written materials the Wisconsin Uniform Judicial Notice of Foreign Law Act, and that says the same thing, that that it is no longer a question of fact, it is a question of law. So most states have moved to that more of a modern approach and at least considering it to be a question of law rather than a question of fact. But that still leaves open the question of how do you establish it? And as you can see in Rule 44.1 and also the Wisconsin statute, which has also been adopted in some other states, it takes kind of a hybrid approach. It's foreign law is not necessarily the same as the jurisdiction's own law. It is a little bit of a hybrid approach. Rule 44.1 and the Wisconsin statute have similar things, but we'll be talking mostly about the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, which is the case construed by the Bodum case. First of all, it requires that the party who is going to be asserting foreign law, who's going to be raising the issue or relying on that anyway, must give notice so that everybody is aware that this is going on. That can either be by a pleading or some other writing. I imagine in most cases it's probably going to be in the complaint. So if the plaintiff asserts that his rights are based upon some foreign statute, that should be pleaded in the complaint. Or at the very least written notice has to be given to other sides. The next sentence of that rule is the one that is really talked about in the Bodum case. And in determining foreign law, the court may consider any relevant material or source, including testimony, whether or not submitted by a party, and whether or not it's admissible under the rules of evidence. So it's a pretty wide open approach, allowing the court to take basically judicial notice of what the law is. But that does still raise the question of how do you establish that? What is the best way of establishing that? How do we prove up foreign law? Well, at common law, really the only method of doing so, and the primary method, was expert testimony by attorneys from the country in question. So, for example, the Fitzpatrick case, which was cited on the first page, was a case involving a railroad accident. I think some passenger on a train at Niagara Falls stuck his head out the window to get a better look, and his head got hit by something. And they were on the Canadian side, and the issue in that case was a railroad regulation about how close things can be to the track, and the question of whether or not that regulation applied was the issue in that case. And in that case, what happened was that the plaintiff brought in an attorney from Ontario to testify that they were in violation of that regulation. And the defendant brought in a an expert to who testified, or an expert who was an Ontario attorney who testified that that regulation did not apply. So it was just like any other question of involving expert opinion, where two experts came in and testified as to their expert opinion as to what the law of Ontario was. And it was up to either the jury or the judge, depending on how conservative they were on that fact of questions of law, of foreign law being a question of fact, depending on how strict the court was in that regard, whether the judge or jury would make that decision. But the information was presented in the form of expert testimony. Well, under under Rule 44.1 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, that still is an accepted practice. You still can have expert testimony. You still can have expert testimony, and since many of these questions are resolved at the summary judgment stage, because it is a question of law now, typically that testimony means that it will be a an expert affidavit or a declaration of, under penalty of perjury. So in most of these cases, and in the Bodum case, it's going to be talking about these declarations. The question is, you know, can this testimony come in by way of an affidavit or a declaration under penalty of perjury? And that is how the testimony of these expert witnesses typically comes in today. Well, when you look at Rule 44.1 and most of these other state laws governing this, it's typically put in terms of being permissive. Some states will say that it the court may take judicial notice of the foreign laws, or in the case of Rule 44.1, it says in determining this, the court may consider any relevant material. It may consider testimony. It may consider evidence submitted by a party. It may consider items that are not submitted by a party. It may consider items that are not admissible. But the wording of Rule 44.1 is permissive. It does not require the trial court to do anything. It allows the court to accept this this material. Well, that can run into a problem because if you have some testimony or some information or some method that you want to use to prove the foreign law, the court may very well accept that, but nowhere in this rule does it say that the court must accept anything. So you kind of have to have your ducks in a row and be prepared to have something that will satisfy the kind of conflicting views around this. The pitfall that you can run into here is from this little exchange that I have quoted in the materials from a Texas case. This has nothing to do with foreign law, but it was this hapless Texas lawyer, for some reason in this case, he needed to establish what the weather was in Lubbock on January the 27th. Under the rules of evidence of Texas, those rules said that the court may take judicial notice of a newspaper report of the weather. And nobody had any objection to it. His opposing counsel didn't want to look at it. He didn't have any objection to it. But the court said the request to take judicial notice of Lubbock Online is denied. The newspaper is inherently unreliable. So that's the pitfall of coming into court saying, well, the court may rely on this testimony. There's nothing in there that says the court must rely upon that. So you do have to kind of have your ducks in a row. As this Bodum case that we'll get to in a minute makes clear, there are differing but equally valid viewpoints that the court can take in considering this, and you have to be prepared to cover all of those. For our podcast viewers, or listeners, our second code word is, the Texas court didn't take judicial notice of the Lubbock newspaper for the Lubbock weather report. So our second code word today is Lubbock, a city in Texas, L-U-B-B-O-C-K. That's our second code word for podcast listeners. So in any event, even though Rule 40, or Rule 26.1 authorizes the court to take judicial notice, it does not require the court to do so. So some caution is called for. Well, the Bodum case, which is the principal case that we're going to be talking about today, gives us some guidance, albeit some conflicting guidance about how to proceed. And as I noticed, previously, this was a case in the Seventh Circuit, Bodum versus La Cafetière Inc. It was decided 621 F 3rd 624. It was decided September 2nd, 2010, by a three-judge panel, and that three-judge panel managed to give three opinions. They were unanimous in that they affirmed the decision below, but they kind of they take somewhat conflicting points of view. We have one judge, Judge Posner, who is very critical of expert testimony. You have the third judge who is cautions that in many cases this kind of expert testimony can be very helpful. And you have the principal opinion by the Chief Judge Easterbrook, who kind of takes a middle ground. But as you can see, they did manage to reach a unanimous decision. So it does show that you can either satisfy or not satisfy all three of these standards, despite the fact that there being a slightly different standard employed by different judges. So at first blush, this case seems to throw more confusion onto things, because there are these three separate opinions. To some extent, they look kind of like commentaries and law review articles. Despite that conflicting those conflicting three opinions, I think we can bring some harmony to it. That's what we're going to talk about. Well, Bodum was a contract case. It was a commercial dispute between two companies that make French press coffee makers. One thing about Bodum, I don't know if you're like me, if you were in law school, you were kind of happy when you got to those cases that had pictures in them. And this is one of those cases with pictures in it, because they show pictures of what these French press coffee makers looked like. And they're typically a pretty good way to make coffee, and you even learn a little bit of French from reading this opinion, because the name of this French press coffee maker is Cafetière à Piston, a piston coffee pot. And if you're not familiar with those, like I say, they're a pretty good way to make coffee, especially if you're just making one or two cups. You put boiling water in this pot, you put the coffee grounds in there, and then there's a little plunger that pushes the grounds down to the bottom and filters them out. But this was a dispute about the rights to manufacture and sell these coffee pots in various countries. And it was undisputed in the case that French law applied, because I think the contract between the parties said that it was going to be governed by French law. So the whole case hinged on the meaning and interpretation of the law of France, and in particular in this case the statutory provision that was really at issue was this Article 1156 of the French Civil Code, and there was a stipulated translation of what of that provision, and it said that in reviewing agreements, the court needs to look at what the common intention of the contracting parties was, rather than pay attention to the literal meaning of the terms. So this provision of the French Civil Code, and I think if we scoured the common law books, we could probably find almost exactly those same words describing U.S. contract law, that the common intention of the parties takes precedence over the literal meaning of the terms. So if it's clear that everybody meant something, that's what we go by, rather than the literal meaning of the words on the paper. Well, one of the parties, and he was probably didn't have the better of the argument, and he kind of seized upon that phrase and tried to make it look like that was just this extraordinary provision in French law that was quite different from American law or common law. And his argument was that he had an affidavit. He testified as to what his intention was, and his intention was different than the literal terms of the contract. Therefore, his position was that there needed to be a trial on the issue of the party's intent. And the other side said, well, no, you look at the contract, look at the common understanding of the parties. It's a pretty clear-cut case, and it can be decided by summary judgment. So he brought in affidavit from his expert saying that the common intention of the parties was what controlled, and that we had to look, we had to have a trial on what the intention of the parties was. And the other side brought in affidavits saying that, no, French law says something else, and we don't need to do any such thing. We don't have to have a trial on the intention of the parties. So the question, the question in the case was whether summary judgment was appropriate, and he said no, summary judgment was not appropriate because we have these conflicting affidavits of what French law is, and one of the points is we have to look to the intent of the parties, and to do that we have to have trial. So summary judgment was not appropriate. Well, first of all, I think, fortunately, and the reason why this case prompted these three opinions is because I think it's a pretty easy case. Because, like I say, I think if I don't think that's unique to French law, that provision. This guy's expert put a spin on it, saying that, this is very important. We have to have a trial on the intent of the parties. But I don't think that provision is unique to French law because I think, like I say, I think if we could pretty easily find a common law case that said the same thing, that the intention of the parties, the common intention of the parties, is controlling over the literal terms of the contract. But it has to be the common intention of the parties. You can't say that there's a material issue of fact because one party comes in and says what his intention was without there being any evidence of that being the intention of the other party as well. So I think it was a pretty easy case to decide, and because it was an easy case, the court didn't have much difficulty affirming it. But the question comes up, though, how do you prove that French law? And that's the posture of the case where we have three judges expressing three different opinions on it. And starting with the main opinion by the chief judge, Judge Easterbrook, he first of all points out, as all these judges did, that Rule 44.1 does not say what the court shall consider or what the court must consider. It is merely permissive. It only states what the court may consider. And it states that the court may consider affidavits of experts, and it also may consider these other things. And I think even Judge Easterbrook, he kind of takes a middle ground of the three judges in this case, but he does say that the judges in general should use the best available sources. And he says that in many cases, the court may have at its disposal better foreign law materials than counsel have presented. So he, again, this expert saying that we have to have a trial on the party's intent, well, the party presented that, but the court probably had at its disposal materials that were better than that. Because, like I say, I don't think that's the law of France, even if they prevailed upon one expert witness to say that is the law in France. So he definitely says to err on the side of using the best available materials. And in many cases, that might be things other than these expert affidavits. I think it's safe to say that he discourages the use of affidavits and declarations and expert testimony, even though that might be permitted by the rule, and even though in many cases that might be the best way of proving it. But he points out that, first of all, expert testimony on the law of a foreign country, and especially if it's going to be an English-speaking country or one where the court materials are easily accessible, is that can be very expensive. Any kind of expert testimony is going to be expensive, and especially if both parties have to do it. Not only is it expensive, but as the case with much expert testimony, it adds an adversary's spin, which the court must then discount. And he goes on to say that there are many treatises on French law, including many that are published in English. And these treatises and law review articles are not only readily available in the library or on the internet or on online services, but they will not have this slant to them. They will not have this spin. And he goes on to say that not only is that a permissible way of proving law, but we prefer them to the party's declarations. So Judge Easterbrook, while kind of taking a middle ground between the two extreme positions of no affidavits or always affidavits, he does say that we prefer them. And he also went on pretty easily to establish, based upon mostly a single law review article, a U.S. law review article talking about French contract law, he discounted pretty easily that expert's affidavit, saying that there has to be a trial on the issue of the party's intent, because it's not just the unilateral intent of one party. Just like at common law, the question might be, what is the intention of the parties, in plural? And yes, that might take precedence over something to the contrary actually written in the contract, but there has to be evidence that it is the intention of both parties, not just the one party unilaterally claiming that they meant something different when they signed the contract. So again, I think it was a pretty easy case to resolve, and based upon that, he did resolve it pretty easily and said, no, summary judgment is still appropriate here because there is no question of fact. We don't have to have a trial on the intention of the parties, because the only evidence to the contrary is this one unilateral claim by one party, and that does not overcome the plain language of the contract. Well, Judge Posner, I think he wrote, I think, the longest opinion of the three in the case. He concurred with everything that the chief judge said, but he also went on to say that he wanted to express his emphatic support for and also to amplify. He wanted to criticize, he wanted to jump on board with that criticism of the common and authorized but unsound judicial practice of relying upon affidavits. So he points out that it is still a common practice. It dates back to common law when you brought in the two attorneys from Canada to testify as to what the Canadian law is. That still is a common practice today, and it still is the authorized practice. So despite what he has to say about criticizing it, a judge is still free to consider such affidavits for whatever they are worth, and to rely upon them if the judge decides to do so. So you can't just jump on board with Judge Posner and say, no, I'm never going to use affidavits as to what foreign law is, because there are some situations where a particular old school judge may be expecting that, because that is the common and authorized practice, because the Rule of Civil Procedure 26.1 does authorize such testimony. And for some reason, I have Rule 44.1 written at that point in the written materials, and I think I should have said Rule 26.1 there. But Rule 26.1 still does authorize that testimony. But as Judge Posner says, he is, and any other judge is perfectly free to say, the court doesn't have to rely on that testimony. And from his point of view, in only a few cases should a court rely upon that. And in his opinion, this case is not one of them. I think correctly so in this case, because it's a pretty easy case, because I don't think French law really says what that expert affidavit said it says. So I don't think this was an appropriate case, and all of the judges in this case believed so. Now, at this point, Judge Posner goes on and talks at pretty great length about what kind of information should be considered. And, you know, as he noted above, he said in very few cases should these affidavits be considered. The other judges would probably be more, if they were serving as trial judges, would probably be more willing to consider the affidavits. Judge Posner probably not. And he goes on to speak about changing times, that these materials are widely available. They're available in the library. They're available from online sources. And especially in the case of another English-speaking country or another common law country, they are not only readily available, virtually any law library in the United States, even probably a small county law library, is going to have a lot of English cases, probably English statutes, and certainly they're readily available online, and they are certainly in the English language, so they can be read easily. So certainly, in the case of the law of an English-speaking country, the court actually being able to consider the actual primary materials would certainly be preferable to an expert affidavit or expert testimony, as took place in that earlier case where two Canadian attorneys came in to testify as to the meaning of a railroad regulation. Well, that regulation is probably available online today. The cases construing it are easily available from online sources. But Judge Posner also goes on to say that that's probably also true with non-English speaking countries. So, for example, proving in the case at hand, proving the law of France, the most authoritative source will be the original source documents, the case of a statute, the actual statute. And it can be translated. You know, translations are used by the courts all the time. As he says, they're used routinely in drug trafficking and immigration cases. Well, why not cases about French coffee pots? We can certainly have translations, as indeed we had in this case. And also, he points out that in many cases, there are English language treatises about the law of another country. Well, interestingly, even though he says how easy it is to access the primary materials, Judge Easterbrook, who wasn't quite as much enthusiastic about it, actually did cite a number of French judicial decisions. Judge Posner, however, even though he says that it's easy to get these materials translated, he goes on mostly to cite American Law Review articles from journals of comparative law talking about French law. But that's probably, like I say, appropriate in this case because this was kind of an easy case, in my opinion. There wasn't anything particularly novel about this proposition of French law. But Judge Posner goes on to review what the French law is and conclude, rightly so, I think, that in France, just like in any other country, if you have a written contract, you go by the written contract. You can't. You might be able to bring in evidence that the parties, plural, intended something else when they used a particular word, but you can't come in and say that we need to have a trial because one of the parties intended something different. No, in that case, you're probably bound by what the written contract says. So here, I mean, I think it's a pretty easy case. So you probably don't need to go to a French law school to figure out what French law would hold in this case. This case was unanimous. The third opinion in the case, which wasn't a dissent because he also agreed that the case should be affirmed, but the third opinion was by Judge Wood. And he, he again agrees that this is a pretty easy case, but he's not quite so reluctant to jump on board and say that these affidavits should be just totally abandoned. He says in many cases the affidavits are the way to proceed, in many cases, and I think rightly so, he points out that there are a lot of nuances in foreign law, just like there are in U.S. law. So, if we took a French lawyer and gave him a volume or two of the Federal Reporter and asked him to make rhyme or reason about what U.S. law was on some particular point, well, there are a lot of nuances there. And even if he could read English pretty well, you might have, when you get to some of the finer points, maybe a legal education in the common law system might prove helpful. And the converse might also be true, there are a lot of nuances there. Anybody who took comparative law in law school remembers that maybe as kind of a difficult class. Sometimes it's not always an easy way. It's not necessarily easy to interpret foreign law. So just like any other expert testimony, there's going to be a spin on it. There's going to be, one side will have their own particular nuance to add to it. But that's why we have cross-examination, and that's why the other side can offer an expert. There are two sides to it. It might be more difficult than just the black and white letter of the law. And in many cases, those expert affidavits might prove helpful. I'm just going to backtrack 1 minute. I was confused as to the rule number a minute ago. It is Rule 44.1 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that we were quoting up here. I just wanted to point out, and I didn't point out earlier, that Rule 26.1 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure says more or less the same thing. So if there's an issue of foreign law in a U.S. criminal case, then under Criminal Rule 26.1, the same rules would apply. That rule is more or less identical to the corresponding civil rule. But the civil rule is 44.1 in the federal system in Minnesota. That brings us to our third code word for our podcast viewers, and our third code word is coffee, because this case was talking about coffee pots. So the third code word is coffee, C-O-F-F-E-E. Now, I should say that even though Judge Wood is a little bit more on board with the time-honored practice of having expert testimony and expert affidavits to establish foreign law, he still is not, he's not saying we can't consider written materials. He's not saying, you know, because he makes clear, just like the other judges, that the rule says that the court may consider affidavits, the court, but also the court may consider original source materials. The court may consider anything that's relevant, even if it's not admissible. So he makes clear that that the judge is certainly at liberty to do so, even though just like the judge is not required to consider expert affidavits, the court may consider this kind of testimony. Well, so we have three opinions, each one essentially of the judge stating a personal preference of which kind of proof he prefers. So if you're before a district judge, the district judge may be in any one of these three camps or in more of them. And we don't want to be like that hapless lawyer in Lubbock, Texas, who merely wanted to get a weather report in and thought the rules of evidence allowed him to easily do that. But again, the rule that he was acting under merely said that the court may consider his weather report. He should have been more prepared, and he should have had an alternative method of getting in the weather report, which when you look back, it looks like he did. It looks like he had something from the weather service, so he probably wasn't just totally frustrated there. But you have to be prepared with what you have to meet any of these three levels. Either the old school judge, because as Judge Posner points out, it's still a common practice of having attorney affidavits, foreign attorney affidavits. But some of the judges, like Judge Posner, are not going to be very receptive to that. To prove the case, you have many things that are allowed, but they might not be allowed by a particular judge. So you do have to have all of your bases covered. So what can we take home from this? Well, you have to be able to satisfy all three of those particular leanings and possibly others. There might be a fourth judge might have written a fourth opinion in this case. So you have to be prepared to cover all of them. Now, I think what the main criticism, I think, of the first two judges was that a lot of times when you see these things, they look pretty conclusory sometimes. And I'm guessing that's what the plaintiff's expert in this case said, you know, when he said we have to have a trial as to the intention of the parties. When you see these affidavits in cases, and when judges see these affidavits, a lot of times I think they're worded in a very conclusory fashion. There's not a lot of meat there. So you're not going to be very well served, I don't think, with just a very conclusory affidavit. Those first two judges are almost certainly going to ignore what that affidavit has to say. If the affidavit merely says that, yes, there must be a trial in this case. If you are going to rely on affidavits, there has to be a little bit more meat to it. The judge is not going to necessarily take whatever you offer just hook, line, and sinker, because they're going to be looking a little bit deeper into it. They're just like any other expert. If your medical expert merely says that there was malpractice in this case without any further elaboration, I don't think that's going to go very far. Well, the same is true of this kind of expert testimony, although occasionally lawyers seem to forget that, that not only do they have to put it in an affidavit, but they have to convince the judge. Well, because what you have to keep in mind is that a judge, his job is to listen to legal arguments, and that's what he does every day. He hears the plaintiff's side of it, and he hears the defendant's side of it. So if that expert is going to testify into what foreign law is, he has to take on the role of an advocate, not unlike any other expert witness in a case. And it's probably a good idea if there's a method or if he's prepared to answer the court's questions, because any other legal argument that is made, if there is almost always there is an oral argument, and the most important part of that oral argument on any legal question is typically questions and answers by the court. Well, one possible way, I think, to keep in mind that maybe not the only way to do this, but I think in many cases the preferable approach that would satisfy these three points of view is to have that attorney in the case not as a witness or not only as a witness, but as an advocate for one of the parties, to make clear that he is advocating and let him argue his case well. I quote the Minnesota rule here governing admission of foreign attorneys pro hac vice into a particular case, and most states and most courts will have a very similar rule. And the Minnesota rule, and again most other states, states that an attorney may be admitted to a particular matter if he is admitted to practice in the trial courts of any other jurisdiction. It doesn't necessarily say any other U.S. jurisdiction. So if it's a case like this one where French law is critical and you really want to establish what French law says, one thing I would strongly consider would be having that French attorney in the case not merely as an expert, but as one of the attorneys, so that he can argue that point of law. Now, flying in an attorney just for one argument might not be cost-effective, but having him be the author of the brief and/or signing the brief seems to me that that could be a good way of proceeding in many cases. Because it seems to me that's going to be stronger where he's clearly arguing the law, which is what the court is used to hearing. He can make those arguments as to what the law is rather than just stating them as facts. Because when they're merely stated as facts, a lot of times they are looked upon as being very conclusory. If you're going to make legal conclusions, it seems to me that that doing so as a lawyer is the best way to go. Now, you might run into some of those judges from the old school. As Judge Posner points out, having expert testimony is the common practice, and it is an authorized practice. So another possible way to proceed would be to have him execute an affidavit or declaration in addition to the legal arguments that he makes. Or just to keep in mind that if you are going to do it in the form of an affidavit or a declaration, there's no reason why you can't make it sound like an argument and have him make a persuasive argument. And at least, coach the foreign expert that in this case he's going to have to do what he presumably does at home, namely make a persuasive argument on behalf of his client as to what the law is. But again, the rule of civil procedure says that this is a question of law. So I would think it's going to be a much more persuasive position to treat it like a question of law, rather than still clinging to the to this old common law idea that it's a question of fact. But that can still be in the form of a sworn affidavit, if you think that judge is going to be place more credence upon that than he would upon a mere argument. But still, I think having it sound like an argument. But I guess in conclusion, the main thing to keep in mind is that, like that Texas lawyer who wanted to prove the weather report, this is a case where the court may accept that weather report, but he or she is not bound to do so. And there are differing interpretations and differing preferences by the judges of what the meaning of that rule is, or not what the meaning of it is, but the best way to apply that in their own court. And you do just have to be prepared to deal with any of those eventualities. So the key thing to take away from this, like I say, I think the Bodum case might have added some more confusion, or at least at first blush it does. But when you look at it that way, as that you have these various permissive ways of establishing it, then you can be prepared by going in knowing that you are prepared for what this particular judge wants to do, because this judge can be in any of those groups. Well, at this point, I'm going to, for our conference call viewers, I'm going to unmute everybody, and I will just pause briefly for questions. And I have not had any email questions. Once again, our podcast viewers, or listeners, I should say, if you do have any questions about the program, please email them to me at clem.law@usa.net, and I will promptly answer those. At this time, I'll stand by for our live conference call viewers to offer any questions. Are there any questions?
Have any here in Cedar Rapids.
Okay. Well, I will. I thank all of you for participating again today. I will email out certificates of completion for you within at some point today. And thank you very much for joining me. And I look forward to having you participate in these calls again.